Now, in a 7-2 ruling last month, the U.S. Supreme Court said a 40-foot cross that honors soldiers killed in World War I could remain on state property in Maryland. Some local residents saw the cross as a government endorsement of Christianity and sued to have it removed. But the Supreme Court said while crosses started out as Christian symbols, they took on added secular meaning when used in World War I memorials. It's just one of the latest examples of what our guest says is the Supreme Court lowering some of the walls between church and state. He says that even though the court says all religious beliefs should have a voice in the public square, Muslims, atheists, Wiccans, Satanists, and other non-Christians continue to face challenges to achieving the same freedom of religious expression as do Christians. Jay Wexler is a professor at Boston University School of Law. He's also a former clerk to U.S. Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg and a former lawyer at the U.S. Department of Justice. He's the author of the new book, Our Non-Christian Nation, How Atheists, Satanists, Pagans, and Others Are Demanding Their Rightful Place in Public Life. Jay, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me on the program.
Well, I know you were watching this case. I think when you wrote the book, this had just been taken up by the U.S. Supreme Court. Can you talk a little bit about that case and how it illustrates this wider picture you're painting in your book?
Sure. This was a case, as you said, about a 40-foot cross, which is also a World War I memorial on public property. And it was challenged, and the argument was that it was an endorsement of religion, and so there was therefore unconstitutional under the court's precedence. So I, as sort of a masochist, I went to the Supreme Court to watch this argument. You know, I'm an atheist, but I grew up Jewish, so I'm a religious minority on many levels. And for some reason, I wanted to witness this argument to see what the justices were going to say. I knew it wasn't going to go the way I had hoped. So I sat there kind of in amazement for 70 minutes as the justices debated whether or not a giant cross like the size of King Kong on public property was a religious symbol or not. And, you know, to me, that's a pretty easy question. Of course it's a religious symbol and it should not be on government property. But the Supreme Court unsurprisingly held that it was also this other kind of symbol and so therefore was okay. And it is an example of how the Supreme Court over the past 20 years has really tore down this wall of separation between church and state. Not that it was ever that high, but it was a little higher than it is now, and it has become very clear in cases like this one and a few others that it's getting lower and lower over time.
For a long time, you write, the argument was over a standard that had been set of, okay, is this symbol, whatever it might be, a government endorsement of a particular religion? How long did that last as kind of the guiding light for the Supreme Court?
Yeah, well, it was invented, I guess, in 1985 in a concurrence by Justice O'Connor. It sort of became the rule of the court a couple of years later, and I think it's now buried under a giant cross in front of the Supreme Court in the year 2019. So how many years is that? 34? Something like that?
Now, in your book, you talk a lot about these kind of head-on battles. Do we allow this religious expression on public land? Do we not? But a lot of your book opens up another door or looks at another door that's opening up where, okay, if one group, in most cases Christians, religious symbols or expressions are allowed in the public sphere, what about everybody else?
Exactly. So for most of the century or whatever, the last 100 years, minority religions and atheists didn't want to partake in public life. They wanted public life to be pretty much secular because that protection, that the limit between separation, the separation of church and state benefits religious minorities and atheists by preventing the government from taking a position on religion, which is usually in favor of the majority. But now what we're seeing is that religious minorities are understanding that the separation of church and state battle has for the large part been lost. And so the question is, what do you do in that situation? Do you just sort of give up? Well, what many minorities are doing is saying, well, these cases are about Christians, but I guess we can take advantage of them also. If the government can put up a cross on public property, then they can put up a 9-foot statue to a cult figure, which is what the Satanic Temple has asked several states to do. Minorities have said, hey, if Christians could start off a town board meeting with a prayer, then we can start off the town meeting with a prayer too. And so So many minorities, Wiccans, atheists, Hindus, and Satanists also have asked and have been granted approval in some cases to give an invocation before a town board. And there are other instances that I talk about in the book too, but those are two of the most interesting ones, I think.
Talking to Jay Wexler from Boston University's School of Law. His new book is called Our Non-Christian Nation, How Atheists, Satanists, Pagans, and Others Are Demanding Their Rightful Place in Public Life. I want to spend some time on some of the different stories you tell, and you really dig into these. One that I thought was really interesting, and it kind of relates to the Peace Cross one that we started off with, the story, the case of a U.S. service member who had expressed his belief in a Wiccan faith and whether or not a Wiccan symbol could appear on his tombstone at a military cemetery.
Right. That's just a fascinating story. And from my perspective, it's one of the great stories of the book, one of the success stories. So there are many Wiccans in the military. And one of them, one Wiccan died in Afghanistan, and his wife wanted him to be buried with his headstone to have a Wiccan pentacle on it in the National Cemetery. But the Veterans Administration said, sorry, you can't have that. That's not one of our 39 or whatever approved symbols. There are like 19 crosses and a Jewish star and a few other things, but there was no Wiccan pentacle. And she was like, are you kidding me? So she got a group together, including Selena Fox, who is in Wisconsin at the Circle Sanctuary there, and they basically put on a full press effort to get the VA to approve the Wiccan pentacle. They got nowhere until they hired they enlisted Americans United for Separation of Church and State to bring a lawsuit. And what happened in the lawsuit was it became clear that the reason why the government wouldn't let a Wiccan pentacle be on a national cemetery headstone was because the government didn't like witches. It like just basically that's the story. And so when this was discovered, the Veterans Administration realized that it was the law was not on its side, and it gave up and it approved the Wiccan pentacle. And now there are at least eight headstones in the National Cemetery in Arlington, Virginia, which have Wiccan pentacles on them. And every year there are a group of Wiccans from the D.C. area who on Memorial Day go from each headstone, you know, to the next and do a little Wiccan ceremony to honor these Wiccans who serve their country.
Now, part of what makes your book unusual as a law book is it isn't just the law and the court cases. You actually visited with a lot of the groups that were at the center of these cases, including a field trip here to Wisconsin. Talk about your visit here with Selena Fox and Wisconsin's Wiccan community.
It's amazing. The Circle Sanctuary, if I remember right, it's about 45 minutes outside of Madison. It's this beautiful, very large, very lovely piece of land. There's a little cemetery there. There's a barn where certain rituals and other things take place. And Selena Fox, who is a pagan priestess, is just the nicest person, and she's been battling for Wiccan rights for decades and has had many successes. And she's just a lovely person who's sort of one of the heroes of the book. And just and visiting that place and talking to her and learning from her and other Wiccans who were there at the time was really one of the highlights. Like, it's one of I can't understand why professors stay in their offices all the time when they can, if they so choose, go out and meet people who they're otherwise, you know, just reading about in print, which is, you know, it's great to meet people and see things. And that's what I like to do in my work.
Right. I can't imagine during your law school training, you imagine it would lead to you being a careening down a hillside on a four-wheeler led by a Wiccan officiant.
I never imagined that, but I'm so glad that's where it's led me.
Now, these issues are going to get bigger, probably. You talk about the demographics of the United States when it comes to religion. What kind of changes are we seeing?
Right. So at the same time we're seeing less and less separation of church and state, we're also seeing more and more religious diversity in the United States. We see fewer people who are identifying as Christians. We see more people who are identifying as religious minorities in various ways. And we see a real growth in the number of people who identify as so-called nones, N-O-N-E-S, people who don't believe in any particular religion at all. And that is a trend that is expected to continue. And so what we're going to have is more and more religious diversity, fewer and fewer Christians, and the wall of separation lower and lower. And so those are the two kind of phenomena that kind of made me want to write the book, because the question is, well, what does a religious minority do in a post-separation of church and state nation? And so that's in large part what the book is about.
We continue our discussion on freedom of religious expression with Jay Wexler. He's a law professor at Boston University. His new book is Our Non-Christian Nation, How Atheists, Satanists, Pagans, and Others Are Demanding Their Rightful Place in Public Life. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think religious minorities get a fair shake in the public square? Do you think that you should have religious prayers opening government meetings? Does it matter which religion? Should everybody have a shot at that? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll go to your calls now. Mike is with us in Appleton. Mike, hi.
Hi there. How are you guys doing today?
Good. What do you think, Mike?
Here's my thought process. I'm actually a practicing Lutheran, and you know, I'm also a college graduate. And I know that, you know, upon reading the Constitution, the Freedom of Religious Clause allows us to practice any religion we want to, or in essence, no religion at all. It is our freedom. Having people, you know, conduct things in public, you know, is all fine and dandy, but I see what a lot of religious individuals, that they're not willing to give the equal time to other faiths just because they practice, they worship a different, you know, representation of God or gods than they do. I think it's got to be everyone gets a fair shake or nobody gets a fair shake.
Mike, thanks a lot for that call. And Jay, that reminds me, at a few different points in your book, whether you're talking about that prayer at a public meeting or a memorial on public land, if it's Christian, people get behind it. If it has to be opened up to other groups, atheists or Satanists or whatever, sometimes that motivates people to just shut the whole thing down and go all secular.
Exactly. That's one of the interesting things that I observed in researching the book. For example, this happens quite a bit with the Satanic Temple, this group out of Salem, because Satan has this way of really getting under people's skin. But for example, the city of Phoenix had this program where it started every meeting off with a prayer, and it was always Christian. But the Satanic Temple said, "Can we give a prayer?" And the town said, sure, I guess you have to. But when it became clear to the residents of Phoenix that Satan was coming to town, they freaked out, and basically the city shut down the prayer program altogether. And so now nobody gives a prayer before public meetings. So that has happened a number of times in a various different contexts.
Mike, thanks for that call. We'll go now to Jenny with us in Rice Lake. Jenny, hello.
Hello, good afternoon. I just wanted to kind of say that I am a closet atheist as far as my work colleagues go, because I work for the Army. I always find it very uncomfortable at the beginning and now the end of all of our functions, even to include our LGBT month event, that it starts and ends with a prayer that you have to stand for. I just wanted to kind of throw that out there, that it really does feel off-putting, and it's supposed to be one of the organizations that is open to all religions, and yet these benedictions are always from a Christian standpoint. There's never been, I would even like to hear a different faith benediction be said, but it's always Christian.
Jenny, thanks a lot for that call. That reminds me, Jay, you talk about a Supreme Court standard that some justices try to apply of coercion. Is the setting of this religious presentation in effect coercing people to participate, whether they're believers or not?
Exactly. So that's the approach that the court takes, particularly when it comes to prayer. So the reason why the teachers can't lead students in prayer in public schools is because students will feel coerced into participating. And the court has extended that coercion analysis to these sort of town meetings and legislatures. And the idea is, and the reason why it doesn't find a problem with opening a town board meeting with a prayer is because it doesn't think that adults will feel coerced into participating in the prayer because, you know, they're grown up and so they'll just sit there quietly. The problem is, or one of the problems is, if you have a really small town board and you're coming before that board with like a zoning request or something like that, and you're an atheist and everybody stands up to do a Christian prayer, won't you feel like you kind of have to participate in that prayer to get a fair shake before the board? So I think even under a coercion test, which I don't think should be the test, I think the cases should have come out differently.
Thanks for that call. We're talking to Jay Wexler, law professor. His new book is Our Non-Christian Nation, How Atheists, Satanists, Pagans, and Others Are Demanding Their Rightful Place in Public Life. Back to your calls now. Natalie is online in Postville, Iowa. Natalie, hi.
Hi. I was just calling. So the town that I live in has like lots of different cultures, so obviously we have lots of different religions too. And our school system has a prayer room for the Muslim students that we have. And they even put out, like, they sent out emails to teachers saying we need to excuse students during this time. Yet the students of other faiths are not awarded that same option of having, like, prayers in school. We are told, you know, the Muslims need this, but we, you know, Christians don't need it. Wiccans wouldn't be allowed to pray in school.
Natalie, thanks a lot for that call. And there's a question, I guess, of what do you have to do to accommodate, if anything, to accommodate different religious practices, Jay?
Exactly. And so individuals, students, can pray in schools on their own, and they can do so before school and after school and during breaks, et cetera. The issue with the Muslim prayer area and sort of letting Muslims out of class to pray is that their religion requires them to pray at particular times. And I think if another religion were to come forward and show that they also needed to pray in particular times and ways, and they needed to be accommodated, then the public schools would have to accommodate that practice exactly the way it accommodates the Muslim practice. But I don't think that that's the argument that Christians are making, for example. They're not saying we need to pray in exactly this particular time, so we have to get out of this class. That's the difference.
Natalie, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Jay, you see a lot of potential positive benefit if we do, in fact, see diverse groups showing up in the public sphere, whether it's leading that prayer or moment of silence or whatever it might be at a government meeting, different groups having memorials on the public space, different groups maybe having religious schools that might be funded in part by governments. What do we get by seeing lots of different groups represented in this way?
Well, I like the idea of having a lot of religion in public life, all sorts of different religions, sort of mixing it up. What I call it in the book is a kind of religious cacophony. It's very messy, I concede. But I think if you have all sorts of religious people doing what they believe, telling other people what they believe in public life, we're going to learn a lot about each other. And if we learn a lot about each other, we might learn to also mutually respect each other, tolerate each other. And, you know, this is kind of my dream, although I don't know if I certainly can't prove it to be the case. But my hope is that the more pluralism, religious pluralism we have in public life, the better chance we have of having social peace over the long run as we understand each other. We meet each other. You know, people aren't as scary when you actually meet them. Like, you might think, oh, atheist, geez, scary. But if you meet an atheist, you know they're atheist, turns out they're totally fine. You might feel differently about an atheist. And I think, you know, that could be multiplied million times under this public religious pluralism that I talk about in the book.
This, I mean, it kind of fits into an American tradition in a way. If you think of different groups within Christianity, where, you know, in Europe it might still have been tough to have Catholics and Protestants or different kinds of Protestants in the same place at the same time. We saw a lot of that from the beginning in the United States.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a great point. We've had a lot of Christian diversity, and we have in the past had certainly anti-Catholic bias and anti-Catholic even riots. But these days, for the most part, you don't see that as much, and maybe that's because of this the public Christian pluralism, and perhaps we'll see the same thing happen if we go even farther than simply Christian pluralism to religious pluralism more generally.
In our last minute or so, Jay, getting back to the law side of things, is there a case or a kind of case you're watching for in the court system now?
Well, I believe the Supreme Court just granted an important case for next term, where the question will be if a government has a voucher program where it gives money to private schools, can the government exclude religious schools from that program, or does that violate the religion clauses of the First Amendment? And that's an interesting question It's a little bit different from the things in my book. When I suppose one big question that's working through the courts now that's more related to the issues I talk about in the book is whether a government can exclude atheists from giving prayers before boards. Like, even if they have to allow other religions, can they exclude atheists on the grounds that, you know, atheists can't really give prayers? And at least one court has said that that's true. Other courts have said differently. Maybe that'll work its way to the Supreme Court too.
All right, your sequel's about two-fifths done, Jay. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me on.
That's Jay Wexler, professor at Boston University's School of Law. He joined us to talk about his new book. It's called Our Non-Christian Nation, How Atheists, Satanists, Pagans, and Others Are Demanding Their Rightful Place in Public Life.